Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Bobby Ann Mason. She's got a new novel out. It's called The Girl in the Blue Beret. Bobby Ann, welcome back.
Hello, nice to be here again.
It's been too long, Bobby Ann. What have you been up to?
I've been writing this novel. It takes a long time to write a novel.
I get the feeling that the idea for this novel has been on the back burner for a while because I get the impression that your family inspired you.
Well, this was a story that was in my husband's family. His father was shot down in Belgium during World War II. And so I had always known about the story, but really it had never occurred to me to write it as fiction, that it would be a springboard for a work of fiction. And it didn't occur to me until 2 years after he died. He died in 2004. And he had written a memoir about his time flying in the war and then as a TWA pilot. And in his memoir, he had written about his escape through France with the help of the French resistance. And I had started taking a French class in 2006. And all of a sudden, everything clicked.
Mm.
And I tried to imagine him there at the mercy of these French people who might very well turn him into the Germans. And he didn't know French. And so I was trying to imagine, how did that work? What did he go through? What did it feel like?
I was amazed to read the book and find out how many pilots went down over occupied Nazi territory during World War II and managed to get out. Do they have any estimate on how many of them managed to escape?
At least 3,000.
That's amazing.
And there must have been many thousands shot down, many who were killed. But those who were helped by the resistance organizations in the various countries to get out and somehow get back to their bases, usually in England. It is an extraordinary aspect of World War II that I don't think we generally hear about very much. Those who went through it certainly have their organizations, their networks, but I haven't seen it treated much in the cinema or novels.
So where does the connection come through where you're diverging from the story of your real life father-in-law's experiences, and then you go into the fictional account that you've created here of a guy who has a lot of similarities? Where do we go into the imaginative realm with this?
Well, there's one very essential thing to know, and that is that when an airline pilot is forced to retire at age 60, some of these guys are just too young to retire, and so what are they going to do? They live to fly. And so I thought that is the place to start, to imagine a guy maybe like my father-in-law, but what would he do? I know what he actually did. That's where my fiction began. And I thought something would provoke him to go back and retrace his steps during the war to try to find some of those people who had helped him back then. He had turned his back on all of that and gotten on with the prosperity in America and becoming an airline captain. So he was the type of guy, I'm talking about my fiction now,
mm-hmm.
who didn't have any other plans, any other loves in his life. So that was my premise. What would he do? How would he take this retirement? And it seemed a very, very good year. It would be 1980 to start this story because he was at an age where people start looking back at their lives and reassessing themselves and what they've been through. And this was a critical point for him because he was forced to retire. And then he goes to France to look for the people, and it's a critical point for them as well. it's along about that time that they start waking up from this long amnesia they've had about the war. They hadn't wanted to confront what had happened during the war. Many of them were collaborators, and, of course, many were in the resistance. These were just subjects that were not easy. So this was a time for them to start reevaluating, and it was a time for this man at age 60 to start reevaluating. So the two threads came together.
Bobby Ann Mason joins us. Her novel is The Girl in the Blue Beret. And this guy you imagined, your protagonist, he's 60 years old. He's just had his mandatory retirement as an airline pilot. This guy's had this fairly glamorous life flying to these capitals like Paris, France, and all over the world flying the big jets. And he really hasn't devoted a whole lot of time to his family, has he?
Well, he's away a lot. And he is one of those guys that's so familiar, the strong, silent type. He doesn't show his emotion. This is all about learning what one is supposed to feel and getting in touch with his emotions were about the war. He was just a kid when he was flying bombers.
And he's a kid from Kentucky.
He is. He's from the mountains, but he's one of those people who leave and then don't look back. And he left when he was just a child, and his family moved to Cincinnati. So that's one remove, but he didn't want to be associated with that background of the mountains. That starts to surface a little bit throughout the novel as he starts getting grounded. He's forced to be grounded, and then he has to learn how to live there.
And this is a guy who would have kept flying until, well, till his dying day.
He
loves it.
Yes.
He loves to fly.
Yes. When he's brought back down to earth in this way, then he has to start seeing things differently. And so to go to France and to try to find the people who had helped him during the war, he enters into a world he didn't know. He enters into situations where he hadn't fathomed the sacrifices people had made to help kids like him and the risks they took. And then the hospitality they express when he goes back, the bond that they feel so strongly with the American, allied aviators who were, who came over to help. These people he meets have very strong memories of the B-17s coming over, whole clouds of them streaming toward Germany with their bombs. And so the people who lived under occupation were so enormously grateful to see this happening. And so when parachutes came down or there were crashes, many people tried to rescue these aviators and to take care of them and to hide them from the Germans. Marshall Stone hadn't given this much thought later on. He hadn't realized what strong feelings these people still held. And, of course, the people who lived under occupation, they want their children and grandchildren to know about this and to remember it. So their effort is to perpetuate this expression of gratitude so that their history won't be forgotten. And so this is the world that Marshall enters into.
The book is The Girl in the Blue Beret. It's the new novel by Bobby Ann Mason. She joins us by telephone today from Kentucky. And Kentucky is very much a part of you and a lot of your work, isn't it?
It has been. I was ready to leave, so to speak, and writing this novel that takes place in France. So I went on an adventure myself.
You still got a little Kentucky in the book, but I'm guessing that you spent a lot of time doing, quote, research in France. I'm just kidding.
It was a very good excuse to go to Paris, don't you think?
Exactly. And you also probably went up in the Pyrenees and spent some time up in the mountains?
So to speak, I went on a little day trip across the Pyrenees. We drove up to the pass and then hiked across to a very nice restaurant in Spain.
Good.
And then came back. So I could say I crossed the Pyrenees, but driving up to the mountain pass, well, actually, that was just totally scary. Those little switchback roads. I don't want to do that again. I almost think I'd rather walk. But the pilots who escaped from the occupation and were helped by these resistance, many of them crossed the Pyrenees, and their crossings were just horrific. I read many accounts of these. They crossed at night. They couldn't see. They were led by a Basque guide, usually, who didn't slow down and didn't stop for anybody to eat. They hardly had any food. The trip would take maybe 3 days, and they'd have to hide during the daytime. And then they would be up to their waists in snow. And if they couldn't keep up with this guide, they were left behind. So I read some really horrifying accounts.
I think your readers are going to thoroughly enjoy your technique in having him retire, go back to France, try to find these people that helped him during the war when his plane went down. And then you cut in with flashbacks and memories and recollections by him and by other people so that we get that sense of how it all happened, the crash. It slowly unfolds for us, his escape, all of that. And as you build up the suspense, as they're flying, it was amazing to me to read the description of how they had these thousands of planes all flying in formation. It was mind-boggling to picture this. Nothing like this has ever happened before or since, has it?
No, and I have someone marveling about how there would never be a sight like that again, 1,000 bombers in the air. And the technique it took to swirl all these planes into a formation was just marvelous. The B-17 is an extraordinary plane. It was meant to do long-range precision bombing. And, of course, it was a little unwieldy. And when they rolled down the runway, they sort of jiggled from side to side. And they made a very distinctive sound.
And they called them the Flying Fortress.
The Flying Fortress.
And you described the pilot's spot there as almost like sitting on a throne. Don't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Comparing it to being in a medieval fortress and sitting on a throne. And except you weren't surrounded by a moat. You were in motion. You were in the air.
And if you were that gunner on the bottom of the plane and the plane was going down, you better move fast.
And the gunner in the belly turret will on a landing with the wheels not down, that he could just be smashed. All of those gunner positions were very precarious. The tail gunner has to sit in the back, and the fighter planes would come at the tail. And there are waist gunners out the side. The bombardier in the front, the pilots themselves were not manning machine guns. And there's a point in the bomb run where the pilot gives steering control to the bombardier so that the bombardier can locate exactly where to drop the bombs. So the pilots then feel just helpless.
They're just sitting there waiting for the bombardier to give them back the yoke.
Yes. And so everything that goes on with the B-17 is just, your word is mind-boggling. It's just extraordinary. And to think of these guys who loved it, who just loved flying these planes. And, you know, there are several of these B-17s still flying around. They go to airports and for people to come and look at them and go inside and even take a ride in them.
You have a character who sort of hovers over this entire story. He's present on many of the pages, and we keep thinking we're going to meet him. And I'm wondering how you came up with the idea for this particular character, this fellow who helped him escape, and he has a very mysterious background.
Robert Jules LeBeau. Well, Marshall, when he remembers hiding, there was a young man who always came over with messages and supplies, and he just seemed to be a really active and enterprising young man. He would find food in this time of austerity. And Marshall was envious because there he was, cooped up, being hidden, while this young man was free to come and go on his bicycle. So in retrospect, Marshall has rather romanticized him. So Robert is one of the people that Marshall very much wants to find. At least he has a memory and a clue. So he keeps looking for this guy, and he hears various things, which I won't give away.
But as he hears these things, he becomes increasingly more puzzled, doesn't he?
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense to him.
He's a very mysterious character, and as a reader, we keep wondering, who is this guy? Because he's a cipher, in a way.
Well, I think we understand certain things about what happened to him.
There's a lot of mystery involved in all the characters, all the outcomes here.
Mm.
Don't you think?
Well,
like Annette. Let's talk about Annette.
She is the girl in the blue beret.
Yeah.
Who was a schoolgirl who had been his contact and guide in 1944. He was told to find the girl in the blue beret who would be waiting at the train station. He wasn't exactly sure he remembered her very well, but things keep coming back to him. And so he wants to find her, but she's very hard to find. And once he does find her, he finds out a lot,
mm-hmm.
I'll put it that way. And I'll tell you a couple things. Robert Jules LeBeau, the name I took, was the actual name that was on the fake ID card that was made for my father-in-law.
Oh.
So I just thought that would be fun to use that name, which was a fictional name.
Uh-huh.
And it was a nice name. LeBeau means handsome, and Jules means boyfriend. So I was interested to think that these French women who were coming up with these names were picking these appropriate names for these handsome young American flyers who came their way.
Hmm. And these flyers, as they'd escape, because they were so afraid of being detected by the occupying German army, they would instruct them to do various things like, don't smoke cigarettes, don't pretend you're a deaf mute.
They couldn't smoke cigarettes in public because they didn't know how to smoke the French way, how to hold a cigarette the French way.
Uh-huh.
And when they were out in public on the train or whatever, they had to pretend to be deaf mutes. And this is rather funny, really, because it was as though France was filled with these deaf mutes.
All reading newspapers and reading them very slowly.
And all of them tall.
Yeah.
With large feet.
Watch out for your footwear, too. Yeah, you have all these wonderful little touches. Did you get these in your research? Did you find them out from your father-in-law? Where'd you get all this information?
A little bit of here and there and things made up, but I don't know. There was an awful lot of good material, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
If you start looking into this.
Would I be stretching it to call this a love story?
No. No.
Because it really is.
I think it is.
Yeah.
And when I said that this is about somebody learning to feel, learning to be in touch with his emotions, that figures in.
But of course, we can't say who's in love with who. But at one point, we think maybe there's something going on with that woman running the grocery store.
Oh, well, she's attractive, and Marshall is attracted to her.
And much younger.
And she's much younger, mm-hmm. and but she's someone on the trail he's following.
Uh-huh.
There's more than one love story in here.
Lives are complicated, aren't they, Bob?
Yes, and this wartime makes you wonder how you would behave yourself if we were occupied by a foreign country, if there was a war going on, if there were warplanes flying over. You know, would you rise to the occasion? Would you be able to do some of these things that the Europeans had to do
mm-hmm.
and found themselves doing? There was so much courage. And, you know, the resistance is a very complicated thing. Many aspects of it, many views. But this particular part of the war, these networks that were formed to help the Allied aviators and the people who took them in and fed and clothed them, this was very real and very heroic, I think.
Many of the French in your story come off as heroic, and the Germans don't come off too well. We have a character, a very peripheral character in the story, who's the son of the former pilot who was in the crash. And this guy went on to become a pilot himself in Vietnam, and he's got almost a stereotypical viewpoint of the French. And I thought to myself, Bobby Ann's thrown in a little editorial comment with this character, because when I think about these French and the acts of heroism that they were willing to do to save all these pilots, I think, well, you know, we have short memories to think that the French aren't patriotic, or that they weren't helpful to us, you know, when France wasn't willing to get involved in one of our more recent wars. You know, they came up with the term freedom fries. I thought you were throwing in a little comment with this character, because he was one of these stereotypical, oh, those French, you know, you can't trust them. But that's not true, is it?
No, it's not. Not in my experience, and not what I've read. This is something that arises out of our own short-sightedness.
Mm.
The French are very proud. They have slightly different standards of behavior than we have, and so mm-hmm. those come into conflict sometimes.
Bobby Ann Mason joins us. Her new novel is The Girl in the Blue Beret. Do you read the New York Times?
Yes.
Did you happen to read the Saturday obituary section?
I don't know. Who was it?
There was an obituary in there for the former governor of Rhode Island.
Oh, yes, I did read that.
Could you believe that when you read it? It says, his name was Bruce Sundlin. Quote, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, Bruce Sundlin enlisted in the Army Air Corps and became a bomber pilot in Europe.
Uh-huh.
In 1943, his B-17 was shot down and he parachuted into occupied Belgium. He made his way to France, where he joined the Maquis, a rural guerrilla arm of the resistance. With them, he made nighttime raids on German convoys near the Swiss border. I thought, I had just finished reading your book and I saw that obituary. I thought, Bobby's ripping her story right out of the headlines.
There were many stories like that. I read many, many stories like that. There is an organization called the Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society, and this outfit exists to celebrate the bond between American aviators and their European helpers.
Uh-huh.
Exactly what I've got in the novel, this bond between those two groups. And many, many stories documented in this organization. I've read many of them. It wasn't the usual case that they would join the Maquis out in the woods and start helping the resistance.
Well, you did have one guy do that.
Yes.
You did. It wasn't our main character, but it was one of his crewmates.
Right.
I saw that and I thought, wow, I was impressed, because I just finished the book.
Yeah. Well, once you become aware of something like that, you'll start seeing it everywhere. Isn't that the way it works?
You're right. And unfortunately, that generation is fading into memory. And there was another coincidence. This fellow, this Sunland, he was born the same year as your father-in-law, 1920.
And Marshall Stone.
You've been in publishing. You've been writing books for a long time. I'm wondering, have you seen a lot of changes in the world of publishing since you've been involved? I know there's a lot of consolidation in the publishing industry. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's a very scary time for everybody involved in writing and publishing. It's because of so many unknowns. We don't know where it's going.
Uh-huh.
We don't know what the e-books are doing to book sales. One difference is that I'm talking to you on the telephone instead of being sent to Yellow Springs.
Mm-hmm. The book tours, they've curtailed, haven't
they?
Oh,
yes, yes. I'm personally trying to go to as many independent bookstores as I can drop in and visit, but because I think it's very important to support these stores.
So you're not planning on stopping by Borders? I'm just kidding. That's a bad joke.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well,
wow.
Wish I could.
Yeah, there you go. That's the turmoil in publishing when you see one of the biggest bookstore chains, boom, gone.
Yes, but you know, somehow I think that those big bookstores just had too much stuff in them, too many other things besides books.
Uh-huh.
And this, it may not work, but there is the opportunity left for the small bookstores to have this very specialized focus and to continue a literary community.
So that could be the silver lining.
I hope.
On the cloud. And as Marshall sails through it in his B-17, he's just dreaming about that really good cup of coffee. Well, I really enjoyed the book, Bobby Ann, and we really appreciate you being on the program today.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad you liked the book, and hope to talk to you again sometime.
The book is The Girl in the Blue Beret. Bobby Ann Mason wrote it. She's joined us on the program today. Thank you so much, Bobby Ann.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Here's Bobby Ann Mason describing the squadrons getting ready to attack. Quote, "Squadrons join squadrons, becoming 60-ship combat wings. Before long, there were nearly 1,000 planes from all the air bases in England, the mighty 8th Air Force of heavy bombers with their loads. It was intense, impossible to exaggerate, enormous. And later, when their fighter escorts arrived hovering above, it was a truly colossal force. It was a sight the world would never see again, Marshall thought. These redoubtable goose flock Vs hell-bent toward their target, hundreds and hundreds of aircraft, clouds of them. The flyboys rode through the tangled currents of slipstreams for as long as 8 hours, their adrenaline levels shooting sharp. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.